You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Welcome all of you here today. It's wonderful to see so many faces bright and early on a Friday morning when it's beautiful outside. So thanks for following through on your desire to be here. My name is Bonnie Jenkins, and I am a non-resident senior fellow here at the Brookings Institution. I'm also the founder and president of the Women of Color Advancing Peace and Security, or WCAPS, as you can see from up here. I want to thank the Brookings Foreign Policy Program and the Brookings Communications staff for co-hosting this event with WCAPS. I want to especially thank Bruce Jones and Tamara Wittes, who have been such great collaborators for this program. I also want to thank all of the moderators and panelists for agreeing to be part of this morning's discussion. WCAPS was founded just last year with the goal to advance the leadership and professional development of women of color in the fields of peace, security, and conflict transformation. WCAPS believes that global issues demand a variety of perspectives, so the organization is cultivating a strong voice and network for its members while encouraging dialogue and strategies for engaging in policy discussions on an international scale. The organization is also committed to advancing the leadership and professional development of women of color. Right now, there is no significant or sustained voice from women of color who have often the most affected by issues of peace and security and who are also community leaders in many parts of the world. WCAPS works to fill that gap. In looking at the landscape of issues that concern women of color in the peace and security space, one that came into clear focus is how we, the U.S., define our national security. Now, why is this a concern? It is because how the U.S. views its national security and then determines how it will address what it defines our security threats will directly impact not just Americans here in the U.S., but people abroad. WCAPS became interested in how our national security strategy affects women of color here and around the world. The organization came to this issue with a national security lens that is colored by consensus and concerns that are not just countries that are adversaries to the U.S. and how the military will address those adversaries. WCAPS considers what are the quote-unquote non-traditional threats that are becoming more significant, and both are and will increasingly impact the security of Americans, such as climate change, infectious disease, food and water security, and others. In preparation for this discussion, I reviewed some definitions of national security. There are several. One such definition of national security is, quote, the protection of a nation from attack or other danger by holding adequate armed forces and guarding state secrets, unquote, which is what we would anticipate as a traditional definition. However, the definition goes on to say, quote, the term national security encompasses within it economic security, monetary security, energy security, environmental security, military security, political security, and security of energy and natural resources, end quote. Another definition states simply that national security is, quote, a collective term for the defense and foreign relations of a country and protection of the interests of a country, end quote. In my perspective, the first more expansive definition is more accurate today in light of the threats that we face, threats that come from many different sources, and not from one or two specific adversaries. The strategy for national security can have a focus on traditional threats. However, the strategy should increasingly acknowledge other threats to the United States. The 2017 U.S. National Security Strategy has a significant focus on Russia and China. The theme of dealing with Russia and China as adversaries pops repeatedly in the document. While I won't want to debate the merits of how much of the national security strategy should be focused on Russia and China, it did leave me with a bit of a Cold War feel. The recent U.S. national security strategy did note other issues that are a source of threats to Americans. However, the degree to which these issues are focused on is minimal. By so giving these issues little attention, we miss an opportunity to find a way to address these issues head on. As a case in point, I counted how often certain terms are used in a document. The word military appears approximately 75 times or more. Water security, approximately one or less. Disease, approximately four times. Food security, approximately one time. And biodiversity, approximately one. What we must understand is that national security is not just national. Working to ensure our security is good, but is not sufficient to ensure we are protected. The actions we take as a result of our strategy should be more reflective of a 2018 world. Let's look at what is happening today. We are facing another outbreak of Ebola right now in the Congo. Already one person has died and at least another 11 cases are detected. There is a global program dedicated to this effort called the Global Health Security Agenda, with over 60 countries all working to prevent, detect, and respond to infectious disease threats. However, U.S. programs and personnel who are critical to this U.S. and global effort are facing massive cuts to the program. Do we have a true understanding of how infectious disease challenges our national security if we cut programs to prevent, detect, and respond to infectious disease? Or should we assume that these other areas of threats to our health and environment, which make us all more vulnerable, can largely take care of themselves? And what about climate change? Are we adequately addressing that threat to U.S. citizens, and are our actions here and abroad helping to address this threat? The definition of national security has been used in various ways, and often administrations see fit when it desires to take an action to further its goals. Doing this has been true for both parties when in power. When the recent issue of tariffs on steel was a topic of discussion, there was a focus on steel being an issue of national security. Does that make sense? However, one must also keep in mind that not everyone wants to have his or her substantive area of work viewed through a security lens. There is a concern that security issues may somehow, quote-unquote, hijack these issues, such as food and water security or migration or infectious disease, and bring into these discussions a focus that they do not believe is particularly helpful. In fact, they may feel that a security lens is even a threat to the work that they do and to the lives of the people who carry out the work. So how do we find a definition that includes more non-traditional issues that directly affect Americans while at the same time respects the concerns of those who work in the field? Also, should we ask if the current definitions are adequate and we just have not gotten it right, or do we need a new one? We must also look at it in terms of who's at the table when we are defining our national security. Is the input into the development of the definition reflective of more non-traditional issues in various perspectives and people who have those perspectives? I look forward to this morning's discussion that will address some of these concerns. The first panel will get at some of these more strategic questions about how do we define national security and whether we need to redefine it. The second panel will drill down a bit and focus on how some of these quote-unquote non-traditional security issues affect the security of not just Americans, but people around the world, and also how these issues are impacted by the definition. With that, I'd like to welcome to the floor here our first distinguished panel. I'd like to first introduce Mr. Michael O'Hanlon, who is a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, where he specializes in U.S. defense strategy, the use of military force, and American national security policy. I'd also like to welcome Gina Abercrombie Wood-Stanley, who's retired as an ambassador after 30-plus years in the Foreign Service. I'd like to also introduce Heather Hulbert, who is a director of the New Models of Policy Change Project at New America's Political Reform Program, and Ms. Sanam Nanargi Andalini, I hope I said that correctly, who for over two decades has been a leading international peace strategist, and in 2000, she was among the civil society drafters of UN Security Council Resolution 1325, A Women, Peace, and Security. I'd like to welcome all of our distinguished panelists to the floor.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Mike O'Hanlon, and I'm privileged to be part of this amazing discussion with these amazing women today. I want to thank Tamara Wittes and Bonnie Jenkins for inviting me to be part of a remarkable discussion, and thanks to all of you for being here on this lovely Friday morning. I'm going to turn to our panelists in just a second with really the big question of how should we think about redefining national security, but just a couple of words first. The main thing I want to say is I want to encourage all of them to be as autobiographical as possible in answering their questions if they so choose. We can make this very theoretical and Brookings-like, but we can also make it a little bit more exciting by hearing about some of the amazing work these people are doing and have done in their lives, often in the field, but certainly in ways that affect policy in very important ways. And I want to hear those stories, and I'm sure you do too. So I hope that we'll interpose autobiographical accounts with more conceptual discussions. I also want to just say one more word of broad framing, which is that as I ask each of the panelists to begin our conversation by giving an initial answer about how to redefine national security, how they would recommend that we do so, I'm very open to this discussion and I agree with this discussion. My own personal involvement at Brookings is often on sort of the Chinas and the Russias of and the defense budgets of the world, but I was a Peace Corps volunteer and former Zaire, the DRC, and one of the next panelists actually is from the same city where I was a volunteer. We certainly, as well as everybody else here, think about how to view problems of refugee flows. Beth Ferris is here as well to talk about that. Climate change, problems that were not as serious perhaps at earlier stages in history and have become more serious and could be threatening even to the territorial integrity and classic definition of national security of various states. So that's a part of the conversation that I certainly hope we'll hear about. But I also want to push the panelists and just invite them to respond in the following terms, that if we make that definition of national security too broad, then we start to make the words less meaningful, perhaps, because we start to capture everything under a common frame. And so what I want to propose is a little bit of a taxonomy, three different categories of security. There's national security of the classic type, Russia and China attacking us or we attacking them or what have you. There are these new threats like climate change that could affect an entire country, you know, take away all of its territory if it's an island state, for example, or lead to such massive refugee flows that countries' very cohesion is threatened. So that's a second category where national security in a fairly traditional sense could be affected by new threats or growing threats. And then the third category is human security, which I think in some cases may be a better term to describe some of the issues that we're talking about today than national security. And I'm just going to finish here by noting one thing I learned last year in a study with General Ray Odierno, and we looked at urban security around the world and benefited from the research of a lot of other people and visited a lot of cities in Europe, the Middle East, Latin America, and the United States. And one thing I saw in that study was that if you, you know, there's a lot of preoccupation with terrorism in the American national security debate, but if you look globally at the deaths per year from all terrorism combined, it's way too high, but it's a lot less than certain other categories of violence. So 30,000 or so deaths per year, even in the broadest definition of terrorist-related violence, you know, civil wars in the broader Middle East, for example, that involve elements of terrorism. There are 100,000 people a year who die from war broadly defined, but there are almost 500,000 who die a year from homicide. And that's often more of a question of human security or urban security or local security than it is of national security. And I just want to press our panelists to explain from their point of view just how far we should expand this definition of national security and where it becomes counterproductive or it's better to talk more in terms of human security. So with that long introduction, I appreciate your patience. I just wanted to frame the discussion that way. And then we'll just work down the row here, starting with Heather. And so please offer your own definition or your own thoughts on how we should reconceptualize national security. And thanks to all of you for being here today.
Great. Thank you, Michael. And I really want to congratulate both WCAPS and Brookings as a staffer at a sister think tank here in town. This is clearly a secret formula to get a full room on a Friday morning and B, that holy grail, lots of younger event attendees. So clearly planners should be paying attention to this formula because this is the kind of room that every think tank in town would kill to get at an event. So now we have to live up to that. So you asked for us to be autobiographical, Mike, and it's I've gotten to the point in my career that I feel like this is the beginning of the third wave of how should we redefine national security that I've lived through, which really speaks to both, I think, what a turbulent time we all had the good fortune, remind ourselves of that when we get up every morning to have our careers in. But also it should be cautionary about some of the things that haven't worked about previous efforts to redefine national security. And I would say the first one, of course, is that I finished my undergrad in 1989 and so came into the workforce where many of the core tenets of national security that I had been laboriously taught as an undergrad were suddenly in question. And got to watch how we responded to that or failed to respond to that, both as national security professionals and as a society. And the second one, which I think Sanam will be able to talk to much more because I think that's where you made your career, was the effort in the 90s and 2000s to redefine security globally under a human security frame. And that, I'll say, just to be a little controversial right at the beginning, had enormous success in a global context, and it was a complete failure in the American context. And so as we start to think about this again, I think we now also have to say, if we're honest among ourselves, among friends, that what we as the national security community did to redefine national security after the end of the Cold War has not been the unblemished success that many of us wish that it were. So maybe as we have another go, if I'm lucky enough to be in the field still and get a third go at this, we want to think about that. And the point that I want to bring to this discussion is that we have failed to recognize that this is happening at two levels. And one level is the one that we participate in every day as think tank people, as academics, as op-ed writers, as national security professionals. And that's where we sort of think in terms of the kind of taxonomy that you put forward, which I think is good and fair. But we have consistently not thought about, and actually maybe over time gotten less and less connected to, the way that national security is a political construct that is defined by politics in the United States, and it is defined by interest groups in the United States, and it is defined by the mass public insofar as it is represented through interest groups and insofar as those interest groups make security issues one of their priorities. And that, I think, is the structure that we can use to think a little bit about how we would do things differently this time. Because I would argue that over the last 5 to 10 years, actually, national security has been redefined out from under the feet of the professionals. And that national security has been, over the course of my career, been redefined into something that is much more military in focus than it was when I was a young person coming to intern events at Brookings on my lunch hour. And that construct has become much more narrowed at the same time as the security anxieties of the public, which can be fit into those three buckets that you talked about, many of them have been redirected toward military tools. So that people who have anxieties, which are the anxieties of being a human being in industrial and post-industrial times, which are anxieties that get reflected in economic terms, they get reflected in terms of gender conflict, they get reflected in terms of cultural and racial conflict, and they get reflected in terms of terrorism and military conflict. Those, in many cases, are now being steered into the idea that those are things that our security apparatus can fix. If you look at polling data, there's a really significant swath of our electorate that draws a seamless line from ISIS to things that they are uncomfortable with or insecure about in their own communities. And as highly educated, highly analytical national security professionals, we may find that intensely frustrating, but it is a reality that we have to figure out how to deal with. At the same time, we have the phenomenon that the many folks who have been working very hard to, say, insert climate change into the national security construct, and who, by the way, have had great success in convincing the folks who do our military planning, the folks who do our intelligence planning. They don't need to be convinced that the climate is a security issue. You know, that battle is won. But where the battle's not won is that even political forces that recognize climate to be an important priority don't see it as fitting in the political construct that is national security, which we use to deal with a sort of specific set of psychic anxieties. So as we think about how do we as policy professionals make those definitions, I would urge that we also think about how we connect our best understandings of what's really going on in the world, which you'll hear a lot about on our second panel this morning, ways that connects back to political forces that are active in America now. And I would maybe close by pointing out that that's not as hard as you think. And that what's actually really interesting is that a number of political movements on both the right and the left, some that would consider themselves highly partisan and political, others that wouldn't at all, really do have sort of core takes on core national security issues. And we in our community are not only not used to thinking about them, but we're actively used to filtering them out and pushing them away. And as much as sometimes that's nice, I would argue that it's been quite counterproductive to our ability to develop and use coherent models. And one example I'll give goes back to the 70s, actually, and that is it's in the 70s that the evangelical movement decides to get engaged in foreign policy and comes to it from a human rights perspective, and then very effectively connects that human rights perspective to the security perspective of the time, which was anti-communism. And there's a wonderful book being written on this out of Trinity University. The author's name, I believe, is Lauren Fishman. Forgive me, Lauren, if I didn't get your last name quite right, but I really, just thinking about how this process of different ways, Bonnie, to your point, of securitizing issues is really something we've been seeing for four decades now. A totally different ideological point is how many people have read the Movement for Black Lives policy manifesto? Okay, Movement for Black Lives has a foreign policy platform. It has a national security perspective. It is one that might be quite unfamiliar to many people in this room, but us as security professionals, we've got to understand the various currents that are going to be shaping, they're going to be shaping the realm of the possible for us. So I will leave it there in my initial remarks.
Thank you very much. And Gina, over to you, please.
Well, I agree with much of what you said. So I went back 30 years looking at our national security strategies, which covered my 30-year career of the work that I did abroad being shaped by that strategy. And certainly in that 30 years, military security, economic security were the predominant themes throughout. But one year, part of the national security strategy was increasing respect for citizenship in this country. There are at times addressing climate change. There are at times touching on food security. So the national security strategy isn't the same every year. Clearly the politics, as Heather said, and interest groups have an impact on what goes into it. My position of this, because my work was dependent upon what that national security strategy was, is who are the people in the room making the decision about what's in that definition? And my position, having been doing this for 30 years, is that we don't have the right people in the room making this decision, that we have a small group of fairly homogeneous people making decisions that, in reality, have an impact on everyone in the world. I don't believe that is an overstatement. So we have a small group that's making decisions for people, for women, who are largely not in the room, for people of color who are largely not in the room. And I think one of the reasons we're all here today and why WCAPS is one of the sponsors is we recognize we're not having the right conversations. So whether we bring in other issues that people are concerned about securitizing, it's my view, having done counterterrorism, that food security is a security issue, that we can have a security aspect of it, but not make it the overwielding framework for discussing it, that we can walk and chew gum. These issues are complex. They are part of national security. So I think we'll have a spirited discussion on that, because I think they should be included. But that we need a far broader definition. And we get the definition because we have a far broader group of people in the room. The reality is, we've been doing this for over 30 years. Are we more secure? I would argue no. I'd say we haven't done it right yet, and we can do it better if we have a full and robust discussion and people informing it, and I'll hold it there for the discussion.
But actually, let me follow up with one thing. Thank you for that, and very useful and provocative and clear thoughts. But I want to ask you to say a little more about what you would define as a national security issue. What for you is the core meaning of that term? Because I'm wondering if you agree with me that a national security threat or concern is something that could affect the nation as a whole or a large part of it, mm-hmm. whereas the human security is about the individual or the smaller group, and whether there's a useful distinction in keeping our semantics clear and distinguishing between those two. So I guess I have two questions. One, do you agree with me that it's useful to actually have two separate things we're talking about here, national security on the one hand, human security on the other, with a distinction between them? Mm-hmm. And then secondly, to the extent you use this national security term, what's an example of a new threat or a broader threat or one that's often neglected that should be considered national security but often has not been? For example, on your food question, mm-hmm. when and why should that be thought of as a national security threat to a nation as a whole?
Right. For your first question about human security, national security, semantics from my perspective, I think human security is national security. And when you made that wonderful example of how many people are killed by homicide, is that a small group of our nation or is that a big group? That's the entire nation. We are all touched by that, made insecure by that fact. So I don't believe I'm going to make a distinction that way. There may be categories to discuss it. There may be a reason to make that distinction. And really, when it comes down to it, it's about focus, it's about attention, and it's about money, resources to do something with these issues. So however we get that attention, that focus, that money, I'm in support of that. So I'm very flexible on that definition. How do we get attention to deal with that? How do we get people focused on that? On the second part of your question, something that should be part of, that is not traditionally part of national security, again, looking at 30 years, military, economics, military. That's always there. It's always front and center. I do believe food security should be part of it. I know that within this nation, we have large swaths of our population, rural and urban, who are food insecure. That has an impact on education. I think education policy should be part of national security because when you leave huge swaths of our population behind, they are not going to be contributing adults. They're not going to be able to keep this nation safe in that broader definition of the word safe. So I think education should be part of it as well as food security, and there are any number of things I think we should be looking at as national security issues. Not that they have to be securitized, but they are important to our security, and the attention, the focus, and the money that we traditionally give to national security issues need to be given to those issues as well.
That's a great answer. Let me add one more thought and then go to Sanam. I may overall have a slightly theoretical preference for a more narrow definition than you, mm-hmm. but I want to back you up with one example, which is that in the 2016 election in the United States, mm-hmm. what we saw is that the anxiety of the middle class fundamentally threatened America's role in the world. And this, I don't mean this as an anti-Trump tirade.
No.
Because I'm actually going to point out that both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders ran on platforms that did not accept the traditional definition of America's role in the world, and they got a lot of votes. And candidate Trump was much more extreme in his foreign policy than President Trump has been so far, because candidate Trump was willing to pull back from the world in general. President Trump is doing a lot of things I don't agree with, but he hasn't actually disbanded and dismantled alliances yet and pulled out of most major organizations. Candidate Trump, this is not a defense of Donald Trump, I'm observing that in the 2016 election, the anxiety of the American middle class was extreme enough that they were prepared as a group to vote for a candidate who didn't really care about traditional American foreign policy commitments around the world, which meant that that election, in a sense, redefined and challenged our definition and our ability to carry out national security the way we had. So whether President Trump winds up being as disruptive as candidate Trump on the foreign policy scene, I don't yet know. But he won the election saying that he was willing to upend the entire global order. And that, I think, backs up your point. And okay, Bernie Sanders had some similar themes. Yeah. So over to you, Sanam. Thank you for the indulgence on letting me
opine. No, it's great to be here. I agree with much of what's been said already. But what I'm struck by is a couple of things. That why does the conversation have to be either or? You know, it's either human security or national security. I mean, it's complex. We are living in a very complex world right now. We're living in a state of extreme pluralism, which nobody talks about, meaning that, you know, just in this room, look at us. We have multiple identities. I could talk to you about U.S. national security or foreign policy as an Iranian, at the receiving end of the policies since the 1950s. And I can tell you every single mistake that's been made that's gotten us to the point right now where we may be facing yet another conflict in the Middle East, which is absurd, right? So I'm sitting here and I can give you that perspective. I can give you the European perspective because I'm also a British citizen and I'm now seeing how it's working out in the U.S., in the U.K. and in Europe. And I can sit here as somebody who's lived in the U.S. for the last 16 years, peering into this world and seeing what Heather says, which is that we went to the Security Council in 2000. We got a Security Council resolution that for the first time in the history of humanity, or the history of the UN anyway, certainly in the history of humanity as well, actually recognized that women have a role and an agency and a place in the context of peace and security. And that agenda, as it came down the Amtrak sort of northeast corridor to Washington, the word peace got thrown out. And literally, I mean, that was like in Philadelphia, or was it Delaware? I'm not sure. But it became about security. And what I've seen over the last, since I've lived here since just after 9/11, is that it's almost like we're in a, it's sometimes I feel as if it's like the U.S. became the Incredible Hulk around the world. It's just all the trauma of 9/11 is still being played out in the rest of the world. And all we can think about is that we're insecure and everybody else is a threat to us. We're not insecure. What are we insecure about? It's the biggest economy. It's the biggest military. It has presence everywhere. It has expanded its presence everywhere. And by doing some of these things and by being engaged in so many of the wars that we see, it's actually becoming more and more hated around the world, right? So our own actions are creating huge problems. If I take you back to Iran of my father's generation and my own generation, what my parents' generation thought about the U.S. was, this was a country you came for your education. It was the best universities, public universities. We've forgotten that public universities educated vast majorities of people in this country, right? That were not expensive. But it was the best parts of the U.S., you know, whether it's the issues around protecting the environment, having sort of a sense of human rights and so forth, all of that has just gotten lost. And we are defining everything. In fact, I work a lot on the CVE agenda, the Countering Violent Extremism agenda. And my question to every audience or every space I've been in over the last 5, 6, 7 years of this stuff is, okay, we're countering violent extremism. We're countering terrorism. We're preventing, now we're saying we're talking about prevention of extremism. What are we for? Have we actually decided what we are for in the world? What are we for? It's a big question. So this has to define it. And I just want to put a couple of other things on the table.
Please.
We've talked a lot about who's at the table and who's not at the table, and they should be. I'm actually more worried about the fact that it doesn't matter who's at the table, whose money is driving this. We've just seen 3 billionaires are driving U.S. foreign policy, certainly around the Middle East right now. Right. So the domestic, we can't separate what's happening domestically from what our foreign policy or security, national security policy is, because we have vested interests in this country that are driving it with vast sums of money. And then you layer that with vast sums of money coming from certain governments around the world who are also shaping U.S. national security, national foreign, that they're influencing it. We don't have an objective body anymore that is actually saying what is good for the U.S. and what is good for, and how do we want the U.S. to be in the world, and then defining it based on that. The money is actually driving much of the agenda around, certainly from my region. So I think we have to, if we want to redefine, it's not just about who's at the table, but actually shedding light on where the money is coming from and how that money is influencing so much of the thinking that goes on.
So let me thank you for also focusing the conversation on U.S. foreign policy. And here we are in 2018, and we all talk enough about President Trump probably for our taste at times. So let me actually look back on the two previous presidents. They were very different from each other. And it's now getting to be a while since President Obama's been in the White House. He talked on the campaign trail about doing a lot of the kind of things that it sounds like you favor. So can you please put these last 16 years or 18 years in some perspective? I mean, you painted with a pretty broad brush, and it almost sounded like you didn't see a difference over the 18 years between Bush, Obama, and Trump. Is that a fair way to interpret what you're saying? Because and the other way I would want to press you a little, and maybe after you respond, Gina and Heather could as well, is that even though there's a long ways to go in the world and a lot of problems are getting worse, there are a lot of things that are getting better, too. For example, our colleague Homi Karas has documented that you can say that probably by 2020, half the world will be middle class, and he defines it in a certain economist way. And this is an unprecedented number. In the 1940s, it was 10% of the world that had that kind of standard of living or better. And in whether it's child survival rates, whether it's life expectancy in general, whether it's maternal survival rates, whether it's education levels around the world, whether it's number of people living in democracies, even though that's plateaued in recent years, there has been huge progress in our lifetimes. So I guess I also want to ask and press you a little bit, because your indictment was fairly sweeping, to first of all tell us, didn't anything get better in the Obama years from your perspective, for example? And then secondly, aren't we making at least some headway? And aren't you really making a call to arms that we build on the progress rather than have to throw the whole baby out with the bathwater of previous foreign policy priorities?
So Obama, Bush, yes and no, right? So yes, Obama was great on climate. He did the JCPOA, Cuba, but he also did Yemen. We didn't need to go to war. I mean, why did we end up enabling the Yemen war and fueling it? I mean, we have to own it. We have to own Libya. The Libya process, I was working at the UN when the decision was made at the Security Council to go into Libya with NATO. And it was a pretty heavy evening because it was like, okay, so what happens next? What are we, you know, and if you look at the playthrough, bombings, Gaddafi is gone, but did we actually learn from the Iraq mistake in terms of what we did with Libya afterwards? It was a vacuum. We created a vacuum and all the Salafis and all the sort of extremist groups fell in. A lot of people complain about the Obama-Syria policy. I actually think that it was the most complex problem that we've dealt with, you know, in generations, because it's so many different wars being played out. But I have Syrian colleagues who, back in 2011, were saying to us, we're not getting resources for education. Education is not part of the humanitarian package. And we can tell you, in the next 4 months, the Saudis are coming in, they're bringing their books, they're bringing their money, the Saudis and the Qataris, we're going to see 60% of this population going extremist because that's where the money is coming from, for food and education and so forth. So yes, there was some progress, but there has to be a mirror where we can look at ourselves, and here I'm putting my American hat on, and say, you know, some of this stuff, we just keep making the same mistakes. And the question is it because the same people are sitting around the table benefiting, there are vested interests in these games, right? The contractors and so forth, and creating the same problems over and over again. These are, it's complex. There's some good, there's some bad. And I'll end with this on a more sort of positive note, if you want. Honestly, I think that the world wants the U.S. to be the good that it can be, right? Everybody's looking for that. People don't want to be Russia and China. They really want the U.S. to be good. But we've reached a point where it's like, oh my God, what are the Americans doing? Everywhere I go, people say this. And I'll just add this. It is remarkable to be to walk around the world with my skin color and speaking whatever languages I speak and having an Allah around my neck, because I get to talk to people in a different way. And what they'll tell me are things that you may never hear. Right, and I get to talk to all sorts of people. I
get to hear them too.
Exactly. We get to, yeah, that's right. Exactly. Funny thing, right? We get to speak to women in Afghanistan and men. Yeah. I get to sit with a group of men and have a very serious conversation about security and the peace, whatever it is, and so forth. And I get to sit with the women. I think that this is why you need a diversity of people in these spaces, in our foreign policy spaces, is because actually when whatever region we're dealing with, whatever issue we're dealing with in this country, you can have the dream team. You're working with, on West Africa, you can have some of the best brains on West Africa in the rooms where the decisions are being made. You're working on the Middle East, get all the Middle Eastern experts, not just of one side or the other. Get everybody, if we're thinking about what's best for the U.S. But there's the tendency to keep excluding and excluding, and it becomes limited to certain people.
Thank you. So, Gene, I want to ask you to comment on whatever you'd like to say at this point. And whether you want to pick up the challenge to U.S. foreign policy or not is your call, but also the broader question about, have we made some progress in redefining national security and in improving national and human security, some of the statistics I quoted and some others, or are we still sort of stuck at, you know, ground zero or the first four?
17 thoughts went through my head while Sana was speaking.
I would think so.
So I'll go first to a quote from Walter Lippmann that was made in 1988, 30 years ago, and I'm going to paraphrase because I don't have it firmly in my head, but basically he said, every year a group of men get together and define national security and how to enhance it and address it, and every year make more or less the same decisions and the same mistakes. And that was 1988, so 30 years ago. He belonged to a sister think tank as well. I believe we don't have the right people in the room. I've been in the room from time to time, and we don't have the right people in the room. The experts, a thin swath of experts are in the room, but not people who have ground knowledge. And the fact is that these decisions have an impact on everybody, women and children, and that's why more women need to be at tables for the peace, not just the security.
And as security. You
talked about, yes, and both. And when you talked about sitting in a room with men and having a discussion about peace and security, you have a discussion with women in the room about peace and security because it has an impact on them. It has an impact on all of us. Have we done anything better? You mentioned Yemen, and that is very painful because you're absolutely right. We should not have, but there we are. I'm looking at Africa, and are we taking the lessons and the habits that we have developed of our Middle East machinations, and now we're taking them to Africa now? So we've lost soldiers in Niger. We're in Mali. Are we making ourselves more secure by taking a military presence to Africa? Are we indeed, as some argue, making more people hate us, making more terrorists who are focusing on us? And we need a really frank discussion and raw recognition of this and change what we're doing as a result, because I think the answers are pretty clear. The answers are pretty clear. I have more, but I'll
stop. So, Heather, I'm sure you got some things to add. I'm not going to really be up here to defend my gender, but I am going to say one thing by way of provocation, which is that even though I agree that there aren't enough women and enough women of color in important decisions and conversations in the United States, in our lifetime, there's been a lot of progress. I mean, most
You
recent...
stole my line.
Okay. I won't say any further. Over to you.
Well, I literally was just sitting up here thinking that when I was born, my mom wanted to join the Foreign Service but couldn't because she also wanted to marry my dad. Mm-hmm. And so when I started my career, not only was there nobody who looked like us, there also, it was the first generation that people with names like O'Hanlon were making their way through. So the degree to which we have democratized how national security policy is made in the U.S. and who is allowed to put their fingers into it, I mean, you're totally right. I used to say, there are a few people here who are old enough, when I was an undergrad, I used to say that my only female role model was Jean Kirkpatrick, and she wasn't really who I wanted to grow up and be. And sure enough, everyone young in the room is looking at me totally stone-faced. Go look her up. She's not my politics, but a pioneering figure, somewhat relevant to some of the things we're struggling with today. So, but the other thing that happened was that as our policymaking was democratizing in that positive way, that more of the talent that America produces was able to claw its way in the door and fight its way up, as Gina did, we also were, along with that came the rise of the ability of interest groups to play across the board in American policymaking, and the ability of money to really play in the ways that, that Sanam has referred to. And we, a mistake that we've made in this field for a long time is to assume that we were different in national security. And over the last 8-10 years, we've gone from the story we all tell ourselves that politics ends at the water's edge, that we're the least politicized. We're now the most politicized part of American policymaking. We're the most polarized. People's views on our issues totally flip-flop based on partisan identity. And that's a reality that we have to get used to. I want to say one other quick thing, Mike. You asked for sort of a historical lens. And, you know, looking way back, the truth is the way that Americans were convinced to take up the role in the world that we've played since our decision to enter into the Second World War, that has had both very positive outcomes and very negative ones around the world, has always been founded on security fears. That we've trained ourselves now over, what is it, 3 or 4 generations. Because during the Cold War, we did an enormous, amazing range of things. I mean, we funded literary magazines through the CIA, and we said that that was a, you know, we had to have literary magazines for our national security. We had to have health programs. We had to fight polio for our national security. We had to fund language education at universities for our, we did an amazing array of non-military things for our national security. And then after the Cold War ended, we didn't come up with a good reason for why we should keep doing those things, and this is something we struggled with in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Then 9/11 happened, and honestly, ever since then, everyone tries to move back into the military security realm because that's where the money and prestige are. And to your point about, you know, yes, intellectually, your three buckets make an enormous amount of sense, but nobody wants to be in the bucket where there's not any money.
Fair enough. Yeah.
So we do have this, I mean, it's older than all of us in the room, this problem that the way we've raised and trained ourselves as Americans to think about the rest of the world is through this lens of fear.
Yes, but that's human nature, I think. I read that in National Geographic. That's human nature. That's how we stay alive, that we worry about everything. I have a question for both of you, if you don't mind, which is, you've talked about the import of money and special interests, which we're all very well aware of in the last 8-10 years, but I don't think that's any different than it was 50 years or 100 years or European politics. Those who have the power and the money are those who make the decisions. And what difference, other than the fact that we're aware of it now, what difference are you seeing?
Well, I don't know the historic context in the U.S. on these things, but the fact that it makes the news that three men in the country funded the equivalent of 44% of the Congressional Leadership Fund and 47% of the Senate Leadership Fund, that must be new news. I mean, that's the extent of it.
The news, not the new.
Right, so it's news, but it's also, is it just the quant, the sheer, you know, did it used to be 10% or did it, you know, how, what's the difference over the last 10, 15, 20 years? In Europe, to your point, in England just now, one of the Brexit, pro-Brexit groups is being fined because the Electoral Commission found that they had spent £70,000 over their limit. Mm-hmm. 70,000. Okay. I mean, that's such a pathetic. So there are tighter rules,
yes.
Right? So, but I wanted to bring, I wanted to just kind of this question of human security, national security. To me, it, you know, in my, you asked for the biographies piece of this. Back in 1996, we had our first conference from women around conflict areas. And there was a South African woman called Tandi Modise who had been in the armed group of the ANC and then went on to become the chair of the Joint Defense Select Committee in the parliament. And she told a story about how as they were transitioning from apartheid to democracy, they were looking at national security and they were very concerned about the fact that the army and the police and all the sort of intelligence forces and stuff in South Africa were, of course, dominated by the apartheid groups. And so they're trying to figure out how to change this. And through their discussions, the party picked up the human security framework. They thought that this was an interesting idea. But the vested interests, the helicopter sellers and the tank sellers and, the defense industry, essentially, came to Parliament and went to the defense ministry and then came to Parliament to approve the purchase of heavy-duty equipment. And Tandy was the woman who basically turned around and said, wait a second, why do we need all this stuff? Let's go and do a national defense review. And what they did was for 3 years, they went around the country and they asked people, what does security mean to you? Ordinary people, ordinary South Africans in villages and towns and cities and so forth. And people started saying things like, well, security is clean water. Security is having street lights. Security is getting rid of the depleted uranium or dirty soil because of the military presence. It was through the poverty, HIV, AIDS. Mm-hmm. So they actually went and I call it democratizing the national security debate. Let's go ask people. What do they think national security is? And I would be really interested in this country, because when you think that the hurricanes that we had last year have cost something like, and I imagine this is a low estimate, of $300 billion, right? People's lives. Ask them what security is. Let's go ask Puerto Ricans what is security when they don't have electricity. So I think that we need to open this space up and not make it this kind of techno expert world of these few people who know about this stuff. No, there are some people that there is vested interest. There are people who want to keep it to themselves. But actually, it should be democratized, and we should have a wider conversation. And I suspect we'll come somewhere in the middle between the hurricane issues and the terrorism or gun violence issues, and it'll all come together in a more inclusive and more appropriate way than what we have right now. And on the Pentagon money, just one thing. I'm a taxpayer. I don't want my money going to the Pentagon. Why should my money go to the Pentagon when it could go to aid or state or wherever it is? Let's have that conversation as well, because it goes in there and it's a black box that they can't even do an audit.
So two things, if I may, that take your point and bring it back to Gina's question. Something I observe with great distress in my looking at public opinion data is that you're totally right that if you went out and said, what does security mean to you, you'd hear a lot about gun violence, you'd hear a lot about opioid addiction, you'd hear a lot about livelihoods. You'd also hear a lot about cultural insecurity and a lot about, I don't like those people not speaking English at my store. And so we are now living in a very divided country along these lines, where there are some constructs of security out there that are in some ways even more problematic than what we're currently dealing with. So that brings me back to Gina's point about the past. And yeah, let's be real, like European national security, which actually even more so, American national security has always been and still is controlled by elites. And what has changed is that there's more contention among elites, and that then we use mass politics to advantage one set of elites over another. And what's marvelous or horrifying about American politics, depending on how you think about it, is that we do have more mass play with our contending elites. Yeah. And that's where I think some of the more extreme displays of, sort of cartoonish displays, yes, like the one you're talking about. So that in a funny way, we've democratized our elites just enough that they can fight with each other visibly in front of us. Yeah.
Thank you. Very rich and fascinating discussion. Now I want to go to all of you, and we took a little more time. I allowed this to go on a little longer because it was so interesting, but we only have about 15 minutes for Q&A. So what I want to do is take a few questions together, and we're going to sort of do one larger round, and then we'll just go down the row and ask each of our panelists to respond to those couple of questions most interesting to you or most directed to you, by way of also closing comments. And then we'll swap out seamlessly without a coffee break, and I'll hand off to Tamara at about 11:15 or 11:20. So why don't I begin here in the second row and then the fourth row. Please wait for a microphone. I think we have them. We'll start up here in the front. And again, we're going to take a few all together. So all the way up here in the second row, please, to start. And if you have a question, if you want to direct it to one person, that's preferred, but as you wish.
Hi. My question... Oh, sorry. Sorry. It's true. Hi. My question, it could be for any one of you, if any one of you want to take it. I totally agree that there is such a wide range of things that should be incorporated in the national security agenda, but I guess my question is, what would be the bounds of an agenda? Like, what shouldn't be incorporated in it? Should there even be limits to a national security agenda? Because I feel like I could convince myself that so many things and so many sectors should be incorporated in it, but is there a point at which the lines are bleeding a little bit too much? Or, because, you know, like, it could go from poverty to education to climate change, which just starts to go into so many different fields. So should there be limits? And if those there are limits, what would those limits be?
And I should have asked you to introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry. I'm Lalitha Ramaswamy. I'm a development consultant.
But, yeah. Thank you. And then here in the fourth row, please take notes on which questions you want to respond to. We'll do that at the end.
My name is Bumi Akinosotu. I am the Chief of Staff of the Young Professionals in Foreign Policy. That's who pays me. And then on the side, I am the creator and producer of What in the World podcast, which attempts to make foreign policy democratized, understandable for regular people outside of the Beltway. And all of my guests are women and people of color. So, yes. So my question is very simple. I'm noticing that a lot of cities have taken on foreign policy, national security conversations and policies. You see it happening in New York. So I'm wondering, if you're speaking to city local leaders here in the United States, what would you, or sort of what role do you see them playing in national security conversations in the future? And do you see this as sort of like a moment in time where after 2020, maybe things sway back up to the federal level and there's some sense of normalcy? Or do you feel like this is the way forward, where now cities are getting involved in international engagements with other cities abroad or other countries abroad?
Super. And we'll go to the sixth row and then over here after that. So we'll stay on this side. Yes, yes, please. And then to the woman over here on the by the aisle.
Hi, I'm Ilana Aquino. I'm actually the vice chair of the board of WCAPS. I'm so pleased to see this event happening, as I know the many conversations that will ripple out from this are really the seed of causing change. My question is, how do we begin to impact redefining national security, having the right people be in the room, having resources directed towards issues that we really believe will make the difference? How do we begin to impact that in tangible ways? And more specifically, what is the work that you would recommend the people in this room go out and begin to do as we re-enter our spheres of influence?
Thank you. And then we'll go over here. You can pass the microphone just two rows up, please.
Thank you. My name is Erin Dempsey. I work for a crisis communications consulting firm. So we work for a varied group of Fortune 500 companies who are interested in national security issues. So my question would be, what industries do you think need to kind of reevaluate their role in the conversation, who may not already be thinking about how they play or how they have an impact on national security?
Great. Let's take one or two more, and then we'll have to wrap up here. So I'll be a little bit democratic in terms of what part of the room I'm calling on. So there's a woman in about the 10th row, and then a gentleman here in about the 7th row, and then we'll, I think, have to wrap up and go back to the panel. So over on this side, woman in the red shirt and, I think, blue jacket and the 10th. Yeah, right there. Please.
Hi. I'm a retired...
Closer to your mouth, please. Can't hear you.
Yeah. My name is Dina Lasso. I'm a retired lawyer. I've done a lot of work on women's rights in the U.S. I am not at all part of your foreign policy world. And I have what may be a dumb question, but something I've always wondered about. You mentioned all the schools that the Saudis fund. I've never been aware. Saudi Arabia is supposedly a friend of the United States. Why is that? Doesn't that seem to be an issue that the U.S. has ever tried to do anything about?
We have.
Okay, and then the gentleman here in the, yes.
Thank you. Daniel Stoll, I'm with Georgetown University, and I think my question maybe is for Gina. When we talk about getting diverse voices at the table and in the room, I'm not hearing actually a lot of conversation about a disciplinary variety. How many of us in this room have studied politics, international affairs, law, military? But I think what you're talking about are hydrologists, agronomists, social scientists, anthropologists. So how do we get those voices in the room along with those of us who have done law and international affairs?
Super. Thank you for excellent questions. So now I'm going to invite our panelists to each take maybe about just 3 or at most 4 minutes, so we stay on schedule, to respond to whichever couple of questions most speak to you or were directed at you, and then combine that with your any final concluding thoughts. And Heather, could we start again with you, please?
Sure. The city's question I'll take because I have a very brief answer to it. That power is not going back in the box. Cities are going to continue to be key actors. Many of the challenges we've been talking about, whatever box you put them in, are going to have to be addressed at subnational levels. And like many other things about this moment that we're in, the idea that 2021 comes and they flip back is just completely misbegotten. So thanks for asking that. LA is another city I would watch. They've got a really phenomenal deputy mayor who's a colleague of ours. And then the question of, are there limits to the national security agenda? Should there be? I loved that question. I would answer it in a two-part way, that we have a whole range of challenges which we're all identifying, which are not being adequately responded to, and which a country as wealthy and diverse and talented as ours is really should be able to respond to. So the first challenge is identifying as a society what are our challenges and how we meet them. And then within that, there's a certain subset of challenges that security institutions are positioned to meet. And, honestly, I don't want the Pentagon doing development assistance. I don't want the Pentagon doing education. I don't want the Pentagon doing, honestly, health research. But the Pentagon does all those things quite well because people are willing to put money there. So in the long run, in my platonic design of U.S. society, national security is a narrow set of things that national security institutions do well. But that requires a massive political change such that we're willing to put resources and talent into other institutions. Last point for me, I'm guessing all of us are going to want to answer the how do you impact question. The most important answer to that is you go out and do things that you do well and love to do. There's no box that you should be trying to fit yourself in, which is something that many of us may have believed at various points in our careers. Second, you do what you do well with an insistence that what you're doing is part of the security conversation. And that's one that takes a little intestinal fortitude sometimes. And last point is you think about what are the sources of power in this country or globally for the thing you want to do. And you don't get sucked into doing work in a way that's cut off from what is the power that can make that work happen. And again, that doesn't mean everybody has to go be a community activist. Everybody shouldn't be a community activist. Some people should stay right here in the think tank.
Don't take that personally.
I meant that in a good way. But there's really no excuse for doing your work without a power analysis and without a theory about how who's out there that you need to be partnering with in order for your work to produce change.
That's a great answer. Thank you. Gina.
On the question about discipline, variety to the room on these discussions, I think it's very important. The bottom line for me is, are people bringing different experiences, different backgrounds to the discussion? And if that's part of that different experience, then a lot of this, as we all know, as we sit in this room, is self-selecting. Is someone who is interested in art history going to want to weigh in on this topic? So it may be putting a call out, making sure that people understand that they're welcome, that they're interested, that we want their opinions and their views. And a lot of it is going to be self-selecting. On the Saudi schools, since I spent 3 years in Saudi having discussions about those schools and Saudi education and who are their funding, etc., our challenge is, of course, that we are this country that says any kind of speech is free speech. We generally stand by that still. And therefore, to put limits on that is not something that we can legally do or that we're culturally comfortable doing. So we did have, and I'm sure continue to have, discussions with the Saudi government about what's in the books. It hates speech, although we use nicer words than that, but that's what we meant, and they knew that's what we meant. that they needed to address, and they certainly said that was not their intent, but it is a very conservative interpretation of Islam. Many things are not acceptable, and many things are thought to be not good, and that's part of the education, and if they're funding a school, then it is their right in this country to say it and to have it shaped like that. And until we're ready to step away from that, that's our struggle. So we have the conversations. Don't think we don't. We do continue to have them. And getting diversity in the room. You know, it's certainly better now. I sit here in some sorrow and had an earlier conversation with Heather. When I left the Department of State, it was my intent to leave a phalanx of people of color behind me, because I know that America needs representatives that look like America, and that we will do our jobs better when we have a wide variety of experiences brought to bear to solve problems. So all of you, anybody not in the Foreign Service, this room looks great. Please think about it, because I must be replaced. People like us must be replaced. And if you saw the photograph with the new secretary, it does not look good right now. It does not look good. So please think about it. Tell other people. We must be replaced. Those of you who are at state, stay. Stay. So you have to be there to add variety to the room. And you have to recognize that one or two is not enough, that we must help each other. Allies must help us, because in the end, it's better for all of us. I'll stop there.
Excellent. Thank you. And Sana, I'm over to
you. Thank you. On the discipline issue, thank you. I'm an anthropologist and a lit major, so I have struggled over the years to see what's the common language. But I think what we need is actually students that are trained in multi-discipline perspectives. That's what we need, because that's the world out there. On the Saudi question, I think one of the problems is that the Saudis and the Qataris also fund a lot of think tanks and universities and places where analysis is done, and media experts and so forth. So it's not just that they're in the schools. They are everywhere. We don't often hear the alternative voices. So I think that it's a bigger problem, and it's been part of their strategies out here. On the question of where do we draw the boundaries, I think what's happened over the last, since 9/11, is that humanity has been slowly securitized. All of us are experiencing this, and all of our, whether it's in our daily lives when you go to the airport or whether it's in the work that we do, it's because the budget in the Pentagon, and it's, you know, this absolute fear that there is. What we need to do is slowly flip it the other way around to humanize security so that we can talk about food and shelter and all these other things, and put the money, as we've said, put the money in that space also. But recognize that if we don't do this, and I think you brought this up at the beginning, if we don't do this and we leave a vacuum, if we're not enabling governments to have education and healthcare services for their people, in Nigeria, for example, Boko Haram is now taking that. Hezbollah is not just a militia organization. It also gives healthcare, right? So that's how we need to be thinking. People, ordinary people, need basic services, whether it's in this country or elsewhere. And if we're not recognizing economic and social rights or the sustainable development goals, or however you want to frame it, somebody else is filling that, and then it becomes a security issue later on. So that's something. To the companies question that was brought up, I mean, obviously the defense industry is having a ball with everything that's going on. The tech industry thinks that they can save us, and they actually have, I mean, they're great, but there's a disconnect between them and a lot of things that are going on. What I would like is to have a serious conversation with the private sector around how they benefit from peace, right? They're taking peace for granted. And peace, we're shredding peace around the world. I'd like to be able to talk to the hotel industry and the airline industry and everybody else about the fact that they need to begin to invest in peace. And it brings me to my final point, that I would love to see national security actually become national peace and security. Mm-hmm. Let's put peace back in the frame. So it's not just about security. It's about being able to live peaceful lives and value it. And what I find with, again, looking back, and I don't want to just be critical, but it is so interesting for me that around the world, people have solutions. Women, we have an alliance of women's organizations in 30 countries. They are strategic. They are extremely pragmatic. They're hands, you know, rolled up. They're doing all this work. We don't listen to them. We don't listen to, you know, the decades and centuries of solutions that exist for water and this and that, whether it's in Iran or elsewhere. The United States is a young country. It doesn't have all the answers. And yet it's wanting to go out and tell the world what to do when the rest of the world is like, we've been there, done that, seen it. You know, work with us. Don't just work at us or on us or against us type of a thing. So we need to really change that paradigm. Thank you.
Fantastic. We're going to swap out now with panel two, and I'm going to give the floor to Tamara. But please join me in thanking this amazing panel.
Policy terms and politically, we have a fantastic panel to help us do that, chaired by Laura Coupe, who is a former appointee in the Department of Homeland Security, a policy analyst at the RAND Corporation, a youth ambassador for WCAPS, and a leader with the Truman National Security Project. She is going to be leading this conversation with Grace Choi. Grace is a former State Department official working in the Office of Global Women's Issues, and she is now the Associate Director for Global Gender Policy at Save the Children. Next to her is Elizabeth Ferris, our dear colleague, a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings, and someone with decades of experience as an expert and advocate on humanitarian issues, particularly refugees and internally displaced peoples. Then we have Mireya Solis, my colleague here in the Foreign Policy Program. She is a political economist and the co-director of our Center for East Asia Policy Studies, a specialist in Japan's political economy. And Tausi Swede, who is a global health expert and the co-founder and CEO of a grassroots NGO called Childbirth Survival International, which does direct interventions for maternal and child health. So with that, Laura, over to you.
All right. Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you again for being here. And I'm really excited to be a part of this event, especially as a youth ambassador for WCAPS, Ambassador Jenkins' organization. I was in eighth grade when 9/11 happened, so a lot of the historical perspectives and the strategic level discussions that the earlier panel had was very appreciated. And hopefully, as me and all the young people in the audience are here, we appreciate that and hopefully take these lessons going forward. So first, I wanted to start by asking the panelists, do you have any initial, you know, discussions or feedback from the earlier discussion? And then, of course, you can keep it light so that you can save some of your remarks for later, but do you have any initial comments from what Heather, Sanam, and Ambassador Abercrombie and Stanley mentioned?
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, I can jump in. I was really struck by Sanam's comment about the securitization of humanity. Mm-hmm. I mean, we certainly see that in the whole field of refugees, where, you know, 20 years ago, refugees weren't seen as a security threat. They were seen as a humanitarian gesture. And I think we can talk further about the implications of that and how that might be reframed. Mm-hmm. But one other thing is we were talking about foreign policy. If you look at U.S. refugee policy, which, you know, has played a leadership role in Republican, Democratic administrations, which all seems to be changing now, but I think the U.S. plays the strongest role when its refugee policy is supportive and congruent with its foreign policy, and when there's a strong domestic constituency. And right now, we don't have either of those, and I think we need to rebuild that in order to see the U.S. play the traditional leadership role it's played.
If I can jump in as well. First of all, it's a pleasure to be here in this event. I found the first panel really fascinating, a lot of very insightful comments that resonated with me. So I just want to highlight three issues that I thought applied so well to the issue area that I work on day in and day out, and that is trade policy. First of all, this notion that the concept of human security has not really gained traction in this country. I could not agree more with that. And I think that if we are trying to understand why the United States is losing faith in the role that it has performed for the past 70 years in believing that you need a rules-based economic order and that opening further to economic integration can bring about the increase in the middle class abroad, but should also address the needs of the middle class here, if we don't understand the failures in incorporating the concept of human security to think about U.S. trade leadership, then I think that's how we begin to see why we went astray. Another important element I thought that really resonated with me was this notion of pluralism, of diversity in terms of the input that goes into the formulation of foreign policy, of international economic policy. Let me just make the point that the United States actually has a very well-developed mechanism, consulting mechanism. It's the most developed if you compare to other countries. And you have all these other communities that sit and discuss and provide input to policymakers on what should be the content of U.S. trade agreements, of U.S. trade policy. But as far as that is developed, it's clearly insufficient. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's a clear legitimacy crisis of trade policy in this country. So what happens is that you have a lot of business interests represented. You do have labor interest, but you don't have enough civil society. And more importantly, I think that the philosophy is one of segmentation. The idea is that you have the labor committee, and then you have the industry committees, and they not necessarily interact. When you think about what is the essence of trade rules, it's all about compromises. Because when you're talking about, for example, the digital economy, you're talking about freedom of data flows with the protection of privacy. And you cannot have just one viewpoint guide the definition of rules. And if you don't bring people to the same room, then you're not going to have that more diverse give and take. It will make us more uncomfortable. It will make the process messier. But I think that this idea that you do need that broader representation, that broader diversity, and that a lot of people are not brought into the table needs to be front and center when we think about how are we going to project forward. And we need to then reflect on how we do it inward.
Chelsea, do you have any comments?
Or? I mean, she just said what I was going to say, essentially in terms of having more representation. So since we work at the grassroots, we are actually more in touch and connected with the communities that we work with. When we're talking about infectious diseases, when we're talking about HIV and malaria, we hear and we see and we feel what these people are feeling. So when decisions are being made back here in the U.S., with no representation at all around the table, it delays funding, it delays action. For example, when an outbreak happens, there's delay in mobilizing resources and the technical capacity needed. So it's essential definitely to have representation in the room so that those voices are being heard and those voices are being taken into account when it comes to taking action.
Wonderful, so thank
I have
you.
A comment.
Oh, go ahead.
Just the panel before, I really appreciated the frankness and honesty, and I'm hoping that we can continue that type of candor here in the second panel. The point that was repeatedly made about ensuring that diverse voices and perspectives are represented when national security strategies are made or national security policies that have global repercussions are made, I think when I'm speaking from my former experience at the State Department and not in my official capacity to Save the Children, when even though there are folks, people of color, who join the Foreign Service at the entry level and mid-level, and when I was in the White House liaison's office, there was a huge priority at the State Department to ensure that there were diverse candidates that were being selected. The problem that I saw, even though we were all fierce advocates of diversity in the national security offices, was that there was not a pipeline of leadership who are diverse. So we would pull from, when you're looking at people who are in politics and foreign policy, it's very, very privileged. It's people from Capitol Hill, from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the House Foreign Relations Committee. Any committee on the Hill is not very diverse. The Hill is not diverse, but that is where people do politics and foreign policy. So then when you're looking at people who are political appointees being considered for senior level positions at the State Department, DOD, et cetera, you are getting people at the entry level, mid-level, special assistants, maybe a DAS, usually not even then. I cannot get diverse resumes for most deputy assistant secretary level positions at the State Department that were political. And we were lucky enough to have Ambassador Bonnie Jenkins there, but why wasn't it why wasn't there an influx of resumes? I think because we have to realize that there is a ceiling when it comes to people of color and women. It's like people are comfortable up to a point like, oh, you're represented, you're here. But as long as you're not managing us, as long as you're not leading us, as long as you're not at the top and telling us what to do, I'm comfortable with that. And so I think it's really imperative. I think someone had mentioned earlier that we have allies. Like, I'm so glad we have this conversation here at Brookings by men, white men who get it and see us and our allies and champions, because you all have the power, most of the power. And so opening up the doors, creating spaces for people of color, for young people, and to help us replace you eventually and learn from you and have that mentorship kind of experience. And that's why I'm so privileged to be here in this room and sitting next to Laura as well, who we serve in the administration together, and to be here with WCAPS in Brookings.
Well, so. Thank you so much for your initial comments. I'm sure the audience appreciated them. So now we're going to take a deeper dive, and like Michael set the stage earlier, be as autobiographical as you want to be, so that way folks can learn from your stories as well. So I know in the audience, someone asked a question about the limits of broadening the definition or lessening the definition of national security. So what are some current global issues that present a challenge to traditional definitions of national security? I know we spoke a lot about 9/11, how that changed the narrative. So could you talk about some current issues, especially from the lens of your expertise? So, Grace, do you want to start?
I think I talked a lot, so I'm going to give someone else, and they can come back to me.
Okay. Do you want to start?
Sure. I mean, as I said, I think one of the big challenges is this securitization of refugee policy, of seeing refugees as a threat rather than as victims of a conflict that occurred. You know, it's really dangerous. I come from a humanitarian background. I spent many years working in the field, working with refugees, and that's where my heart is. Mm-hmm. You know, in my heart of hearts, I wish we had good policies because it's the moral right thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's humanitarian. It's compassion. But that isn't the way the world works. And so how do you find the justification for robust policies to help people who've been forced to flee for no fault of their own? And I think that there are a couple of ways you can do it. You know, one is that in the immediate post-World War II period, the whole refugee system was built on the notion that it is in our collective interest, it is collective security, that refugees are protected and assisted. It wasn't that any particular group of refugees was a threat. It was that we have a better world order. We're all more secure when you don't have hundreds of thousands, now millions of people without a place to call home. And I think we need to make that case that collective security is real security. It isn't just some, you know, liberal, nice notion out there of the right thing to do, but we are all better protected. A parallel I see in the humanitarian world is with the concept of protection, where a lot of humanitarian agencies are not just distributing food and water, but they are protecting people. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, just as you said, this definition of protection has been expanded so much so that it includes distribution of seeds, because if people can't plant, they can't feed themselves, they'll be more at risk. Education is security. You can put just about every kind of development or humanitarian assistance in that protection bucket, just as you see notions of security expanded to include just about everything. I think you can acknowledge the complexity of it and the interconnections, and we need education and seeds and protection of women, etc., while still saying there's something special about safety, keeping people safe, keeping people secure from physical harm is something that we need to emphasize. I remember when I was living in Geneva, a good friend of mine had a teenage son who was having lots of problems with drugs and alcohol and bad behavior and was failing school, etc. And I said to her one time, I said, Monique, what are you going to do with your son? And she said, he just has to survive. If he can just survive, we can fix the flunking out of classes. We can fix education. But there's something special about that survival, security, safety, life, that I think we need to continue to uphold, both in the protection debates in the humanitarian world, as well as the security debates when we talk about national security, human security, et cetera.
Taosi, how about you? Because I know Beth mentioned migration, and usually people also associate disease with that, since folks are moving across borders and using airplanes to
to, you know, go to different countries.
Absolutely. And I think with the most recent case of the Ebola outbreak in the Congo, which, you know, just happened this week, that's a very big wake-up call. If, you know, if the last Ebola case wasn't a wake-up call, this one should be another wake-up call in the sense of how infectious diseases are a threat. Not because they're happening somewhere else, we should not be concerned, because if it happens in a place where people are able to travel, unfortunately where it's happened, people cannot travel as fast as it would have happened anywhere else. But if it comes to the U.S., what does that mean for our national security? What does that mean for our own health and security? What does that mean for the U.S.'s health system? What does that mean in terms of financing and budgeting? So there are all those implications when we begin talking about infectious diseases, and for also the U.S. to have to maintain its global presence in the global health space. You know, we're a leader in the global health atmosphere. I think we should maintain that and not cut on the gains of immunization and building other countries' healthcare systems so that those infectious diseases kind of stay there and don't have to come, you know, and find us here.
Yeah, do you have any insight or thoughts on that, especially from a trade and economic perspective? I think, as Michael also mentioned, with the middle class having economic anxiety, do you have any insight about that?
Let me address first a question as to whether global issues, where we should really have a broader definition and not just look at them from a hardcore national security perspective. Especially Bonnie was making reference to the notion that the latest national security strategy very much has that narrow lens, and therefore we're thinking about defense budgets, military spending, the revival of geopolitics is all the buzz in traditional security studies. But what I would like to do is, first of all, to highlight what are the economic underpinnings of these international systems we seem to be transitioning towards, one that's more fluid, and where, you know, mismanaging the economic angle can actually contribute to more tension and maybe actually be sacrificing some of the economic interdependence that has brought a lot of benefits. And then I can definitely jump into the middle-class question now or later, as you tell me, Laura. But let me just stay with the international, the global issue, seen from this broader perspective. I worry because I think that what we're witnessing is a politicization of economic issues. We're seeing the U.S. government today using trade in a way in which it creates actually a lot of rifts with its allies. You know, we talked about in the previous panel, they made reference to how the United States is losing credibility, losing standing. It doesn't look like it has a positive agenda to put on the table. And I worry very much because I think that we're seeing severe stress in the multilateral trading system. And this is a rules-based system that has given consistency, that has somewhat neutralized, of course, never eliminate, but somewhat neutralized severe power asymmetries, and that provides some certainty to economic transactions. And I worry then that we may actually have two focal points where these trends will come to a head. One is, what happens if the multilateral trading system becomes a casualty to this revival of geopolitics? What does the world look after 70 years of having a relatively well-functioning multilateral trading system when we actually sabotage it? And second, because as you know from my introduction, I work mostly on Asia, I worry very deeply that today the United States does not have an effective and compelling economic engagement strategy towards one of the most significant regions in the world, a dynamo of the world economy, one that's also experiencing a major power shift with the rise of China, and where the United States looks more on the defensive. So at the possibility of abusing my time, let me just bring a little bit of flesh to these two challenges, and I'll stop here. Why do I see the WTO at risk like never before? Some of these challenges are not new. The WTO has not been able to function as a very effective negotiation forum for 20 years, has not updated the rules. But now we are witnessing the possibility that the trade enforcement angle is also weakening severely. So now we have a major dispute in the appellate board. The United States is blocking the approval of three new members. So you have the World Trade Body operating with half the number of judges it needs at the appellate board to be able to make these disputes proceed smoothly. At the time when we're going to have two epoch-making cases coming to the WTO, the case on China's market economy status and the challenge to the U.S. use of national security considerations to block steel and aluminum imports into this country. So that's going to bring a lot of strain. At the same time, you have the two largest countries in the world, the United States and China, articulating economic strategies that, in my mind, seem to want to pick a fight with the way in which we organize international economic exchange. They're picking a fight with the global supply chain. You have the U.S. administration putting on the table proposals that are about bringing to the homeland domestic manufacture, regardless of cost, regardless of efficiency, regardless of benefits to the consumer. And you have also China now articulating a techno-industrial policy that talks about self-sufficiency rates. The idea is, again, to have domestic capability, not this broader integrated structure. And last but not least, I know I've talked a lot, but the fact is that the United States withdrew from a Trans-Pacific Partnership. There were important geopolitical benefits of sending a reassurance to countries in the region that the United States was a resident power and could put forward a compelling strategy of economic integration. What they're hearing today is that the U.S. president talks to other countries as cheaters, and that he wants to use trade agreements to reduce trade deficits, not a dual proposition. And there's no surprise that there's no country in Asia lifting their hand that they want to negotiate one-on-one with this administration. So that's where we are, in a diminished U.S. influence in the region and a multilateral trading system that faces, I think, some of the harshest challenges we've seen in the past 7 decades. And I'm really sorry to be so pessimistic. I'm usually
optimistic in nature, but... I have a response of hope.
Right. No, but thank you so much, Mireya, because I think especially in today's environment, like Bonnie was mentioning, you know, the steel tariffs are mentioned, and folks may not understand how consequential that could be. And then, Grace, you wanted to provide some hope, but I'd also like to have you talk about gender equality.
That's what the hope is, I think. Okay, so I think in terms of global issues that are currently challenging the traditional national security conversation, I think the fact that technology has advanced so much to connect us globally, it's allowed non-traditional players to have a voice and marginalized communities or vulnerable communities, and I'm talking about youth, young people, I'm talking about women. And I think what you're seeing, not only like in our own national conversation with the hashtag MeToo debate, that is enabled by technology to show why gender equality and addressing gender-based violence is important. There's a global movement around it as well. And I think it's, as a South Korean American, I saw how the Me Too movement went to Korea and how South Korea has, even as one of the wealthiest countries in the world, it struggles when it comes to gender equality and bridging the gap between men and women. And gender-based violence is one of, I don't know, I think about 70% at least of women have reported experiencing domestic violence or some kind of violence. And this is from my experience working in the Global Women's Issues Office, working on U.S.-Asia relations. But I think the fact that they're having conversations and that people are putting out their voices to this is integral, is important. What we're seeing when it comes to young people in America with the gun violence movement, I mean, they're high school students, and they are more articulate than people who are professionals here for decades. And it's like, it's so empowering for me, even though I'm a young person, that there are younger people who are like 20 years younger than me who will make the world a better and more stable, prosperous place if they continue to have platforms that allow them to have equal space and footing with the so-called traditional power players. And so as long as we can continue to include and not only include but empower and embrace women, girls, young people, I think in this national security conversation, we'll be at a better place. And one thing I wanted to mention in terms of gender-based violence or GBV is that more lives have been lost through violence against women and sexual-related and gender-related deaths than lives that were lost from wars in the 20th century. So I think it's critical that we talk about gender equality and GBV when it comes to national security issues, both here at home and overseas.
Right. So
So my next question is kind of relates to, again, why we are here. We're having a discussion about redefining national security, why and how. So I guess you, as you know, with your specific expertise, is the how. So how might one reframe national security to account for issues like trade and economic globalization, health, humanitarian issues, and topics related to women's issues? So, Beth, why don't we start with you?
I don't have any answers. Okay. I'm sorry.
You have a wealth of knowledge.
I'm really struck by the parallels between health, trade, refugees, or humanitarian, where you see the impact of changing U.S. policies or leadership on not just other countries in the world, but the system itself. You know, in terms of refugees, I was in Tanzania not too long ago, and you know, Tanzania has historically been one of the most generous, welcoming countries toward refugees, and boy, they are closing the doors, you know, mm-hmm. talking about sending people back, and mm-hmm. lots of bad policies. And when you talk to them, they say, well, if the U.S., with all of its wealth, you know, is reducing the number of refugees, why should we be doing this? Mm-hmm. And thinking about GBV, I was at a meeting in Geneva on GBV with governments. Mm. And I sat there for 2 days, and the U.S. did not say anything. Mm. I mean, you could always count, regardless of Republican or Democratic administration, you could always count on the U.S. to say, this is an important issue. We've got to take it seriously. We've got to do something. Mm. You know, I think there were 38 governments that spoke. And, you know, just that the message that sends to other countries is, well, if it's not important to the U.S., then why should we prioritize it? So I think looking at the issue of U.S. leadership in the context of these multilateral systems that, imperfect as they are, have evolved over years to deal with pandemics or epidemics or trade and so forth, I think that's an area where we need to think seriously mm-hmm. about how to make the case that the U.S., it is in the U.S. interest, it's in our security interest to support these international systems that provide a way of responding collectively to collective problems.
And Mireya, do you have any thoughts about reframing? I know you mentioned that the WTO is not functioning maybe as it should.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And, you know, I would echo Beth's comment about the importance of multilateralism to advance U.S. security interests and to advance global interests. But the way I would tackle this question is to look at the notion of human security, a bottom-up focus on addressing domestic vulnerabilities that then would allow people to feel more comfortable about making international contributions. Mm-hmm. And I say this again because it resonated with me very strongly what the panel in the first session said. And I believe that, you know, a lot of people have talked about trade, the geopolitical implications of trade policy. That's not a new topic. We know that economic statecraft has always been part of the conversation. And in that sense, I don't think there's that much disconnect. Trade is frequently connected to geopolitics, to national security. I can see that. So what I want to address is actually the fact that we talk about foreign policy as an outward-looking exercise without then connecting it to the domestic foundations that will enable that kind of international engagement. And that's what I would like to get at with my brief remarks. I really believe, and, you know, I was not born in this country. I come from Mexico, so I think I'm very surprised sometimes when I look at some of the debates here. But it seems to me striking that there's so much resistance about talking about the safety net, talking about investments in the workforce, addressing really the lack of social and economic mobility. And I, you know, I ended up concluding, and it sounds like a soundbite, but because it is, but I do think that it reflects something. When I was trying to explain in the book I just published a few months ago why the United States now seems to be turning inward, it seemed to be that the answer was domestic, that it has been an attempt to pursue globalization on the cheap. And, you know, every author has a favorite graph in their publications, in their books, and there's one that speaks to me most, and that is when I look, for example, at how over the last 40 years the United States really become a trading nation. The share of economic activity in this country that depends on international trade doubled over these past 40 years. But then you look at what the United States does to make sure that its workforce, that its society is ready to cope with this faster pace of economic change. And it's not just trade, it's automation, it's technological change, it's the fourth industrial revolution. You know it's coming. It has come already. Well, we spend today less as share of GDP on the social safety net than we did 40 years ago. So the graphs, you know, the lines cross. And then why are we surprised that people are very defensive when it comes towards international economic engagement, because we haven't done our homework, and it requires political will. Mm-hmm. And every time I mention this, people immediately jump at me and say, well, on training work, skill training acquisition is expensive, it's not going to work. I would say we haven't even tried it. Mm-hmm. Because the problem is that we use this notion that trade is the problem, and therefore we have developed, say, something called TAA, Trade Adjustment Assistance, and by definition, we're already in trouble, because trade is only part of what is producing this larger social economic change. As I said before, a lot of it is technology. So what we're saying is to the largest number of workers is you're out of luck. We're not going to produce a program that addresses your needs because you were not impacted by trade. We're also creating a certification hurdle because you must prove that your job was lost because of a trade agreement. Whereas, in fact, we should have a broader approach where you don't have to justify if it was the financial crisis, if it was trade, if it was a new technology arriving. The fact is that you need to move on. You need to find a new job. You need to go to a different community. And those kinds of supports are not here. So, you know, if we don't address that, if we don't build a safety net that provides fallback options, unemployment insurance, health care, and lean forward opportunities where you can move to a new job, a new occupation, a new place in this country, then we're not going to really make much progress. And what we're going to do is indeed undo a lot of our trading relationships, and we're going to put more jobs at risk.
And so now diving deeper into the reframing part, what are the upsides and downsides for incorporating development or humanitarian workers when governments define or talk about national security? So I'm sure Tausi has some thoughts about that, especially looking at it from a public health angle.
Absolutely, yeah. And kind of, you know, connecting it with the question of reframing. Right. I think here in the U.S., we're doing a great job in terms of when the CDC launched the Global Health Security Agenda, which essentially is it's a network of organizations and countries that are working together to make sure they're building country capacities in order to prevent, detect, and quickly respond to any outbreak that happens. And I think in aspects of including that as part of a national security dialogue, it's important. Because when we begin looking at diseases, for example, like H1N1, when it broke out in China, or we look at Ebola, these are issues that cannot be dealt with military. We need non-military response to some of these issues. So it's essential and it's important to really look at health and all the other issues as part of the national security.
Grace, do you have any insight about that, especially the work that Save the Children does? And should folks at Save the Children be involved in CVE or CT?
Yes and no. think about us, but don't securitize us. I think it's important to separate, where possible, the international development humanitarian assistance work from national security policies. But it doesn't mean that you are not mindful of that sector. Allow the people who are providing food and vaccines to save lives to do it without being politicized, without feeling like they are being manipulated for a political cause. And if they are being manipulated for political causes, which it normally is, be honest and open about it, not necessarily to the governments that you're trying to hide what your political agenda is from when you're instrumentalizing people, the development assistance. But in terms of the monitoring evaluation that goes into the international development programming on the ground, if you're building a well in X country for political, military reasons, but then you're using M&E international development standards in order to see how effective it is, that's not fair. Just be honest that this is a political reason. If it's not actually water that's going to save and provide nourishment to families in the community. So I think it is important. I did mention earlier that we need to be very cognizant of gender equality issues, and I think there's this tension where it's like you don't want to securitize the issue where it
it puts the lives of the beneficiaries as well as the humanitarian development workers at risk. But you do want to think about the unintended consequences that come from national security strategies and policymaking that are not thinking about a more holistic way of addressing an issue.
And then I want to wrap up. Or Mireya.
I'm sorry. Mireya, can I just jump in on a potential downside, Laura, that you have alluded to with the example of the metal tariffs? I worry that, you know, national security can be used as a protectionist cover, and that that gives a lot of leeway for governments to then have that autonomy, that discretion to impose tariffs. Mm-hmm. And we have seen this possibility actually materialize very recently with a move by the Trump administration to invoke Section 232, rarely used trade law in the United States, whereby the government can say those imports represent a national security threat, and therefore we can either impose a quota or we can impose a tariff. This has been very problematic because the national security grounds for doing this in the case of steel and aluminum are actually weak. The Defense Department has actually said that only requires something like 3% of the domestic steel production to satisfy what it needs in terms of defense production, and therefore we're not really talking about scarcity. The way in which this has also been implemented is that there has been no distinction between countries that are treaty allies of the United States. So, for example, Japan is a reliable security partner of the United States, and nevertheless is confronted with this steel tariff. And then it is creating a lot of friction between the United States and its allies. The Europeans, for example, have engaged in a very intense set of negotiations with Americans, and there should be a decision by June 1st as to whether they get the exemption or not. And if not, there could be retaliation, there could be a WTO case. All of these, again, problematic for many different reasons. One is that the United States is using this to negotiate, and what they're asking of our counterparts is that they accept voluntary export restraints. The Koreans already agreed to this. Argentinian and Brazilian supposedly are getting close to this. Let me just remind you that voluntary export restraints are no longer accepted legal under WTO discipline. So there's a flunking, again, of international trade rules. And if these cases then make their way to the WTO, then they're really testing, I think, what has been the frontier where nobody has there to go when it comes to the WTO, Article 21, the security exemption. And therefore, you have the U.S. government making the case that this is a self-judging situation where any country can say national security applies, and therefore I have the freedom to impose that tariff. Well, this could be, as you can see very quickly, a very dangerous slippery slope. And we're not going to like it when other countries then come and tell us, we also believe that closing this market is in a national security interest. And then where do the trade disciplines go? So I worry then that in this case, I'm all for, you know, the human security angle when it comes to trade, the framing, the formulation of trade policy, but not to hijack trade rules by then invoking national security.
Thank you, Mireya. So as you can see, this is a dialogue, and there's a variety of perspectives. So really appreciate that the ladies were here to discuss this with us. So now we are going to go to our question and answer session. So if folks have questions, please raise your hand and state your name and affiliation. So I'm going to start with the gentleman right there.
Good afternoon. Jeff Stacey from Geopolicity. We're a global development company. Just a question to this panel, really would relate to the last panel as well. But you often hear when these issues come up and this particular agenda arises at forums like this or perhaps on CNN or elsewhere, someone who's resistant to or somehow critical of this will come back with a sort of standard response. And the phrase core national security interests will often get used. And it's occurred to me just sitting here listening to the last panel and this one that that phrase, even though we haven't talked about it today yet, might be relevant in a number of ways to some of the things that you've just talked about and your predecessors did, and I was just wondering if on some level that that is inappropriate in this context, and what specific ways, and what are the sort of consequences of those, and how could that be dealt with?
So does anyone feel very compelled to answer this question?
Take a few.
Oh, yeah, maybe another one. Okay. And oh, ma'am, go ahead. And everyone else raised their hands, too, so that we just can keep track of this.
I'm Sharon Jackson. I'm an independent consultant, I guess. And my question to the entire panel, but you'll probably answer it in different ways, is that one of the ways you can think about national security is cost to society. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that you can think about engagement is, what's the cost of not doing it? So in terms of health, what's the cost that you impose if people don't cooperate? What's the lost opportunity cost of not having trade which promotes efficiency? What's the lost opportunity cost of keeping people out and not allowing them to be as productive as they possibly could?
Thank you. Right here. I'll gather four.
Thank you. My name is Andrea Rotter. I'm a German researcher doing research on security and defense policies. And currently I'm a visiting fellow of the German Marshall Fund. And I'm very grateful to have listened to all of your discussions, because for a German it's very unsettling sometimes what's going on with, with the White House. Yeah. But so it was really enlightening for me, because in Germany, let's say American and German definitions of national security, they often clash. And I think that became very obvious during the Trump administration. So I was very happy to hear that people in the United States are also thinking about a broader concept of national security instead of that narrowly defined military and economic approach. What really struck me was the absence of, like, because it's a big buzzword nowadays in Germany and in Europe, the theme of resilience. I think you mentioned it, perhaps it goes into the diversity debate as well, that a part of resilience, building up resilience, also means civil preparedness and social cohesion. And that was a part I was missing from the conversation so far. So I'd be interested on your take. Thank you very much.
Well, we just answer those three questions then. So does anybody feel compelled
answer.
To jump in?
Yeah, what is the cost of not including women and girls or gender equality in national security? There's a 2015 McKinsey study that a lot of gender activists know that if you were able to close the gender gap in the global workforce, then it would add about $28 trillion to the global GDP by 2025. $28 trillion. That is how much you are losing out on, America and the world leaders. What if you do not intentionally include 50% of your population in your workforce, in the peace process, in health issues, in anything that you do? There's great stats by Inclusive Security as well, and I know Sanam is a leader on this, and thank you for your leadership on WPS and 1325, UN Resolution 1325. But when you include women in peace negotiations and peace discussions, there is a study that shows that it will last to more durable peace. For, I think, 35% of peace negotiations and peace treaties will last 15 years. And so including women as part of your peace negotiations, it leads to exactly what we're looking for. But why aren't we doing it? Mm-hmm. Why is it that it's, I think, 4% of peace signatories are women and 9% of peace negotiators are women? So that's the cost. You don't get peace, enduring peace,
right.
And money.
Beth, any thoughts on the three questions we've had?
Maybe say a word about resilience and preparedness. And I think that at least the humanitarian community is pretty good at preparing for and responding to immediate crises. It's spent a lot of money, time. We know some of the things that work. It's never perfect, as evidenced by Bangladesh and elsewhere. But, I mean, that doesn't seem to be the problem as much as the fact that, you know, most refugees in the world today have been displaced for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. But dealing with the causes so that people can return home, we're finding long-term solutions. And there, I think, is where resilience comes in. Most of the world's refugees do not live in tented camps or camps generally. Mm-hmm. They live distributed among usually the urban population. Mm-hmm. And so ways of encouraging refugee self-reliance, resilience, their own livelihoods, you know, run up against bureaucratic obstacles of usually not having the right to legally work in a country. But dealing with those can certainly do a lot to enhance not just the dignity and well-being of refugees, but also the security impact of having large numbers of unemployed people, often desperate in a host country. So there is a link there with security. But resilience, I think, is probably the way to go.
And I know that, Tausi, especially with on the health angle, there are a lot of costs.
Absolutely. Yep. And, you know, to the earlier points of how much is spent, when there is a pandemic, we spend almost $6 trillion to respond to that pandemic. Unlike if we're able to invest in public health, do you know how much we'd spend? Can anybody give me a guess?
Any guesses?
No, 65 cents per person against a global health threat. So if we're able to help these countries strengthen their health infrastructure, mm-hmm. be able to have the workforce capacity, have the trained mm-hmm. epidemiologists to detect and to train and to respond, mm-hmm. to be able to address issues like HIV, girls' education, because we're talking about HIV in this particular population, which is very high,
yes.
adults and girls. Mm-hmm. If we're able to address malaria, if we're able to address cholera and all these other diseases, we would not be spending so much out of our own, I guess, taxpayers' money, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of that's going out to help these countries solve the problems. So there is essentially the need, definitely, for America to maintain its position in supporting these countries. And through the global health security agenda, that is something that's being done. And through the external evaluations, they're able to see where are countries in terms of reaching that capacity to be able to maintain an outbreak so it doesn't spread throughout the whole country and also the rest of the world and eventually impacting the U.S. as well.
Mireya?
Thank you. So let me touch on some of the questions. My definition of core national security interest would include protection, prosperity, and social resilience. So I think that in that way it becomes very clear why the economic trade angle, but also these social economic policies domestically are so critical to the concept. I couldn't agree more with your question, that what we need to do also is to tell people to disseminate knowledge about what are the costs of retreating inward. And there's a very interesting example. A group of economists, for example, did a thought experiment. What are the costs of autarky for the consumer? I mean, I'm not talking about, you know, the United States is going to lose all trade opportunities, but I think that the most extreme version of it begins to make things very transparent as to how much we actually benefit from a well-working trading system. And I don't know if I have the exact number correctly, but the point was that it is Americans, and this is a worldwide phenomena, it's people at the lower bottoms of the income ladder that benefit the most from access to low-cost imports. And I think that if I'm correct, but I would need to double-check, in this economic exercise of full autarky, going to the most extreme example, I think that people at the bottom of the income ladder would lose like 60% of their consumer purchasing power. So then, you know, that begins to focus the mind. And we're actually in this country beginning to have that more focused attention because we're beginning to see some opportunities that are being lost. For example, the NAFTA debate 5 years ago from today, completely different. 5 years ago, NAFTA was a punching bag from everything that you can think of. Today, we're actually realizing that there's so many communities, economic sectors, even the railroad, for example, there was recently a story in the New York Times as to how the railroad network in this country very much depends on that regional integration platform. So, again, when we lose something or about to lose something, that's when perhaps we pay attention, and we may be at this juncture today.
Mm-hmm. Oh, tomorrow?
Thanks. I'm going to wait for the mic so we get it.
Yep.
So Tamara Wittes here at Brookings, and I've been mulling over what Beth said earlier about collective security and how that's a concept that we used to use a lot in our discourse about national security policy and foreign policy, and we sort of set it aside. And, you know, coming back to sort of the politics of this issue in the United States and how do we build the coalition necessary to bring attention to these issues. We're, you know, a big country with friends to our north and south and oceans on either side, and that means we historically have gotten away with a lot of self-centeredness in our national security policy that countries like Germany, sitting in the middle of Europe, don't get to do, right? And I think that that's really shaped our conversation a lot. When I think back to the eras that Heather was referencing in the first panel, post-Cold War, 1990s, 2000s, how did we talk about those challenges in a way that persuaded the public? We would say, well, some problems like organized crime know no borders. They are transnational threats. We talked about climate change as something that if we didn't work on collectively, none of us individually could deal with it as governments, right? And so we had a set of arguments that overcame that natural self-centeredness of the American public. So my question is for each of you on the issues that you work, gender, trade, humanitarian affairs, health, how would you make that argument to the American public today?
Who wants to go first? Who wants to make their public, I guess, case for their issue area? Beth, I see you shaking your head.
I'm just going back a little bit further. If you go back to 1919, after World War I, when the discussions were being held about the framing of the world order, League of Nations, et cetera, the big issue was collective security. Mm-hmm. You know, collective security was the burning issue of that day, and I think it's really a burning issue today. How do you make the case that we are all better off by investing in these multilateral institutions, norms, principles, ways of working, and so forth? I don't think, at least on the humanitarian side, we have the economic data to make the case. If you don't help Syrian refugees in Jordan, that X will be the cost. But maybe we need to work in that direction. But I'm really struck by the parallels in all of these, you know, that we need these collective endeavors. On the refugee side, I mean, we've seen the biggest problem today is the lack of responsibility sharing. So the host governments feel like they're stuck with large numbers of refugees, inadequate assistance, no end in sight. I mean, we saw in Europe in 2015 the effort to come up with a rational way of sharing responsibility. The arrival of 1 million refugees in Europe, population 750 million, should not be a crisis. It should not be a crisis. But the EU's relocation scheme didn't work. National interests, sometimes security interests, sometimes domestic constituencies, you know, made that impossible. So I think, you know, what Maria said, we've really got to look at drawing the connections between the domestic constituency, collective security, the rules of the game. And, you know, I think there's a feeling among at least some academics that it's all really quite complex to explain the simple popular form that would mobilize people who feel threatened by trade or refugees or whatever.
That's an excellent question, Tammy. I would make the case first and foremost with humility, because we really got it wrong in the sense that I think for a long time the debate on trade made the argument that it was disconnected to the jobs question. And not getting that right is like, oh my God. Why? Because, again, the idea is what was the time horizon that most economists were looking at when they were looking at labor adjustment processes? 30 years. And they were saying, so overall, you know, the unemployment rate of a country is not going to change in 30 years. It all will work out. But I think that Keynes had it right, you know. We'll be dead in 30 years, so we care about that now, and we care about how that impacts our prospects in the next 5, 10, 1 year. It is the short-term, medium-term that matters. And that's where I think, because we were thinking that, you know, when we talk about trade, it's not really jobs that should be front and center, because those are long term. Over the long term, there would be effects that will be taken care of. That's where we went astray. And that's where we need to bring it now to the adjustment question. And of course, trade creates enormous opportunities, but there are disruptions. And trade is just, I think, the tip of the iceberg. As I said before, it's going to be all these other things that we don't get to vote on, but happen. Technology. Mm-hmm. We can, you know, Congress can say, turn its back on TPP, the president can undo NAFTA. All those things may happen, but technology will still make its impacts felt. And if we don't begin by addressing that, we don't have the social policies that allow workers in this country to transition to other arenas and occupations. It's not going to go very well.
And Tausi and Grace, do you have any comments?
I think it's twofold when it comes to health. And, you know, America should look at its history in terms of health, how far we have come, how, you know, access to vaccinations and immunizations has, you know, made children healthier. Some people might debate otherwise. But then also looking at issues like malaria. You know, malaria was one time in the Americas, right? But we don't have malaria anymore. So looking at it from that angle and how healthier we are as a country, of course now dealing with other kinds of diseases which are non-communicable. But then also looking at it in terms of how much do we spend in terms of addressing issues overseas? That is a big problem. You know, if we can only calculate that amount, which I don't know exactly how much, but it's quite a substantial amount of money that we can use to address issues here. You know, we have issues in our cities. We have issues happening in different states, health related and also non-health related. So we can be using those funds differently instead of having to always be funding programs overseas. And that requires investing and helping countries build their health infrastructure and also engaging different people and not only having health people working on health. We need lawyers, we need engineers, we need the media. The media is very important in terms of increasing that information and knowledge, especially the American people, to understand that Ebola's broken out in Congo. That might not be an issue for somebody going to work here in D.C. or in Baltimore, but guess what? If they put on CNN that someone's just got Ebola at Sinai Hospital, Hopkins Hospital, everyone is going to be paying attention. Mm-hmm. And so we don't need to get to that point to be paying attention. We need to be paying attention way, you know, before it actually, you know, it actually happens.
Okay. Grace. I think one just broader point on the addressing the making the case for collective security, especially when it comes to bridging the gap to how we talk about in a foreign policy space and the American public who are not versed on foreign policy, which is a very small privileged group of folks who are all of us here in the room. I think there's a misconception that we have to address that, you know, actually it's not 30 to 35% of the U.S. government budget that goes to foreign assistance, to diplomacy and development. It's less than 1%. And I think that has to be reiterated over and over again, not only to the American public, but to our lawmakers. The lawmakers to make the case to their constituents to say, you know what, when we invest in diplomacy and development, it's a drop in the bucket. But there are huge benefits from it. Your GDP goes up, like I mentioned. You're more secure, you're more prosperous, you are more stable. And don't we all want to live in that kind of society? And I think something else to address when it comes to relaying that collective security messaging, that word collective security, it doesn't make sense. It's very wonky. It's very DC. If you're talking to the American public, I think we need a comms professional that can, like, rejigger it and make it very understandable. And I think it's also how we educate each other. In our education system, when it comes to cultural education and really putting ourselves in other people's shoes and really bridging the gap, I think it can start with how we're educating our youth, how we have humility, respect. Like, these are values that are very American. They should, I mean, I guess it could be global human values or whatever, but they're also fundamentally human, American values, freedom, respect, dignity for human rights. And I think if we could really get to the bottom of that, then we can see each other and say, oh, you're a different person, age, race, sexual orientation, whatever, but like, I can listen and respect you. And I think that can help the American public be in a place where they wouldn't be so scared of refugees and illegal immigrants coming across the border. Because it's like, we're friends, we're in the same community. I see you as my neighbor, friend, family. So that's too hokey, but I really do believe that's important as well.
Yeah, so we have time for one more question. So Sanam, could you please close it out for us? And then, of course, there'll be opportunities for discussion afterwards. So this is only the beginning. So Sanam, could you please ask the
final question? I just wanted to add a different lens on this, which is that the vast majority of people don't actually want to leave their countries. Right. If they have opportunities and hope and dignity there, they don't want to be crossing borders. You know, I'm here because of U.S. foreign policy actions 50 years ago. There are different ways of thinking about our actions. But even to the populists right now, it's, folks, if we invest over there and if we enable the health, they don't want to come here. They have great climate. They have great lives, great culture. Seriously, it's very simple. And that's part of the conversation that's always missed. Thank you.
Agreed. Well, thank you so much again for everyone for coming and taking the time out of your Friday to be here. Thank you so much. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
All right.
Came to from our board on down is an understanding that the problems of governance, which is our remit, the problems of governance in the 21st century require a more diverse and inclusive policy conversation. And they require a more diverse Brookings community. And that's an institutional commitment that we've made, again, from the board on down. So I just wanted to say in closing that I'm very, very grateful to Bonnie, to WCAPS for partnering with us, for helping us learn and grow and advance that effort. Today's event is just one step down that road, and we are looking forward to more. So thank you all so much for coming. Thank you.